Hi, everybody. We're live. So I bought an iPad, of course. That lasted two seconds.
Of course you did. What'd you buy?
Take a guess.
The big expensive one with the nanotexture on it with too much SSD space that you're never going to use?
That's right. And I already returned it.
Oh, oh, seriously? Why?
So when I had said in the last couple episodes, I had said that I'd try one in the store, which is true. And I was wondering, like, does the pencil texture feel better on it? And the answer is yes. But it does not feel $700 better on it. And what I figured out is, so basically, the app that I was discussing in the member special, one of the feasibility tests I wanted to do required the OLED screen. So I was like, all right, let me you know, do some kind of Black Friday deal this year and get myself one of the new iPads. And so I did, except there was no deal on that version, of course.
I was going to say, there's not a lot of Black Friday deals on the one that nobody should buy.
No, there are not. But anyway, I realized that, like, you know, once I had it, like, in my office for testing against my, you know, old iPad that has the rock, paper, pencil screen protector on it, I realized that even though the nanotexture is better for the pen input, it is not better than the rock, paper, pencil. And so, like, basically, like, it's a continuum that you're optimizing for with that. Like, the nanotexture, the screen looked better for images on the screen, for video, for content. Like, the screen looked better, less fuzzy, less distorted than any of the screen protectors. It also reflected even less light than anything. Like, you would think that those would go hand in hand, but they don't necessarily. So the nanotexture was significantly better, in my opinion, for everything except pencil use, which is one of the things I was actually buying. The main thing I was
actually
buying.
Maybe you should wait until you record the next episode of ATP before you return products, because here we have a just-in-time toot from Brian who suggests that you check out Pen Tips at pen.tips for different tips for the Apple Pencil, I think.
I actually had the nanotexture iPad for about 10 days, I think, and I did try both pen tips and the paper-like Apple Pencil tips, because I thought maybe that combination would be better. So basically, there's this whole industry out there of third-party Apple Pencil tips, and they have various goals in mind. The one that comes with the rock, paper, pencil is a metal little ball, like a ballpoint pen. That one I don't really like that much, to be honest. When I'm using the rock, paper, pencil screen protector, I just use a regular Apple Pencil tip. Or I tried the pen dot tips ones. Now, they have a bunch of different versions, and I only tried one variant of it. So maybe I picked the wrong one, but they're a little bit, like, gummy. Like, they're a little rubbery. And so it actually makes the pen, like, squish. It makes it feel more like a Sharpie tip, like, you know, like the regular tip Sharpie. Mm-hmm. So it has, like, a little bit of flex. I didn't like it for, like I like to write really small. I didn't like it for that. The paper-like Apple Pencil tips, I think, are my favorite. They are firm and a little bit, like, fine, almost like a very, very fine sandpaper. Like, it doesn't feel like it's damaging anything, but it adds a little bit more friction. Paper-like tip with nanotexture was better than nanotexture alone, but it still didn't even come close to one of the screen films. So I instead, I returned that iPad, and I got a nice Black Friday deal from Amazon for the regular kind that was $700 less, actually more than that because it was on sale. So it was like $850 less, I believe. And I just got the new version of the paper-like film, which it still is very difficult to install it perfectly. But they have this very, like, overwrought kind of amazing system now of, like, you have, like, these different layers of film, and you peel one back, and you peel the other thing back, and you put this thing, and it sticks this thing under it, and it, like, it's quite a system to see. I still have, like, one dust speck under it, which is annoying, but that's just life, applying these protectors. But I will say, the Paper-like 3 protector is better than everything except nanotexture in terms of how clear the screen is. It is very, very good. It blew me away how good it was. And the texture of the Paper-like 3 protector, along with the Paper-like tip on the pencil, feels fantastic. So I would say my quest here is over. And so far, my OLED screen tests have actually gone very well.
that's good. And saving a lot of money coming back to the don't like nanotexture camp, at least when it comes to handwriting.
I mean, I love nanotexture for looking at. It is still like when I had that like 10 days span of using it, I was like, you know, bringing it to the coffee shop and everything, trying to really like get into the nanotexture iPad life. It's great. I just didn't like the texture when using the Apple Pencil. So if that was not one of my primary goals, I would probably stick with it, especially given how relatively infrequently I upgrade iPads. But it's still very difficult to justify the price.
Cool. Well, I'm a little sad that you don't have a super duper fancy schmancy iPad, but I'm glad you landed on somewhere much cheaper. All right, let's do some follow-up. macOS Tahoe 26.2 Beta 3 appears to have fixed the Electron slowdown as per the Shame Electron website, which reads, quote, good news. This issue appears to be fixed in the latest beta is macOS 26.2.
That's the only report about this that I've seen, but it is from the person who was tracking which apps had the slowdown. And to remind everybody, the deal was that Electron, the web-based framework that a lot of Mac apps use, was using a private API that ran afoul of some optimization or something in Tahoe, and then it caused like system-wide slowdowns in Tahoe and the Windows server, and apps were slowly being updated to use a fixed version of Electron that didn't use this private API or used it in a different way or something, but that was taking a while. Now, apparently, somehow, Apple has fixed it. I only saw theories about what the bug was. It was like overriding some method, and if you override that method in any way, it defeats some optimization that will like not repeatedly call it, like some kind of memoization thing. I'm not sure what they could have done to fix that. Did they just like rename the API or something and then make the API that everyone else was calling a no-op? I mean, I guess they could have. It's all private APIs. Do whatever you want. But yeah, that's the report. 26.2, when it comes out, apparently will make this entire Electron slowdown thing moot, because whether your app has got the new version of Electron or not, on 26.2, it won't have this problem, in theory.
Mark Erman says that Tim Cook's departure is maybe not quite as imminent as we thought. He writes, the Financial Times published a report with three central claims. Apple is intensifying succession planning. Turnus is likely the next CEO. And Cook is expected to step down between late January and June. It's a huge deal that the Financial Times did this. A respected publication should only predict the CEO transition date of for a company of Apple's scale with a high level of confidence based on people legitimately in the know. This is where I have concerns. Based on everything I've learned in recent weeks, I don't believe a departure by the middle of next year is likely. In fact, I would be shocked if Cook steps down in time for the famed outline, by the Financial Times. Some people have speculated that the story was a test balloon orchestrated by Apple or someone close to Cook to prepare Wall Street for a change, but that isn't the case either. I believe the story was simply false.
Okay, I'm calling out editors again. Editor, if you see someone put in test balloon, correct it to trial balloon, because I think it is a more common phrasing of that idiom. Anyway, I don't know if Gurman's sources are better than the Financial Times when it comes to these type of things. I don't recall if he's had... I mean, he did have the Turnus thing early, didn't he? I forget if he picked that up from somewhere else. But he's coming right out. I believe the story was simply false. Now, he's got an out here because he says... He's basically saying, I think it's false that he's going to leave in the first 6 months of next year. So if he leaves at month seven, it's like, see, I was right. He didn't leave in the first 6 months. So it is a very, very narrow claim, but it is a very direct claim, which is that they just blew it. They don't have the story. I looked into it, and, you know, as he says, I would be shocked if Cook steps down in the time frame outlined in the Financial Times. So we shall see. Two stakes are in the ground here.
It's a pretty bold call out from Mark Erman, like,
yeah,
to basically say, like, they're lying or they're just wrong. Like, that's,
yeah. Or they've got bad info. Again, four authors, and the Financial Times is not in the Apple rumors game most of the time.
But he basically says
is, hey, I checked my sources and they say no, so I think it's bogus.
Yeah, but he also called them basically irresponsible. Like, they're like, yeah. That's like, that was a significant call up. But I honestly, it has all of the markings of a controlled leak from Apple. And
mm-hmm. I agree.
And I like, basically, the Financial Times has a lot of bylines on this piece. They are not a sensational publication, and you know, I'm guessing they really double triple check their sourcing on this. Meanwhile, Mark Gurman does not really have that level of oomph behind his denial. He's more like, eh, I don't think so. But that's a very different level of authority.
He does say that he essentially checked his sources. That, you know, I haven't heard anything about this, so I think it's just bogus. But again, the exact wording is like within 6 months. I mean, so here's the thing. if it is actually a trial balloon, it could be that Apple has never planned for Tim Cook to step down in the first 6 months, and this is a trial balloon preparing for January 2027 step down or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's still lots of room for both people to be right here, because when you do a trial balloon, you're just trying to soften things up. That's why it looks, you know, you strategically leak it to the Financial Times, you soften things up, and in your head, in Tim Cook's head, whatever, the plan has always been January 2027, right? But you get the whole year for it to sort of glide out there and see how it goes. We'll see. We've got 6 months to see, but this is a rare case where rather than just saying, here's what, because Grumman does this a lot, is like, this person said this, or this publication said this, and then he adds to it with whatever his sources say. But here he's like, no, no, I don't think that's going to happen. And it's happened once in a while where he would say, like, somebody else said some product is coming out, and I think it's not. But this one, we'll get the answer in 6 months, I guess, or seven.
I don't know. I would also say, like, I would guess Gurman's sources are not as high up as whoever is speaking to the Financial Times about this. Like,
that's true.
Gurman sources, like, look, he has a pretty good track record about a lot of things, but the things that he has a track record about, I don't think are from sources that seem like they're up at the board level, because this would be a board level discussion. This is like,
well, what about
who
the Turnus
would know
thing?
About this? The
Do
board.
You recall if he had the Turnus thing first?
In terms of like Turnus being like one of the top picks, yeah. Or the top pick, yeah. I think he might have,
because that's pretty high level.
I mean, sort of. But like the number of people who would have heard that is, I think, a very different number than the number of people who would hear about the specific plans that the FT published about, and who would leak to the FT about it, and who the FT would trust so much to put four different bylines and publish it like that. Like that, I think, look, Gurman might be right, but I think he has a lot less support behind him when you actually look at, like, you know, what has been laid out here. I think the FT is probably more likely to be right.
We'll see.
All right, with regard to Windows gaming on Linux and ARM, Tyler writes, Proton, which is the SteamOS adapter layer for playing Windows games, runs in user space, and so does any anti-cheat like Valve, EA, or Epic that it uses. Apex Legends, which is Electronic Arts, did enable Linux support when the Steam Deck launched, but last year blocked it after deciding it was more trouble than it was worth. User space anti-cheat is always going to be trivial to circumvent, but Linux users are unlikely to tolerate proprietary kernel anti-cheat. Why is that?
I disagree that they're unlikely to tolerate it. People who have a Steam Deck don't even know or care that they're running Linux. So if there's kernel level anti-cheat on your Steam Deck, they won't know or care. They'll just know that they can play a game that they couldn't play before. But you know, I know what they're saying. Like your average person who's like building a Linux PC that wants to game on it might be annoyed by having to recompile their kernel with something or add an extension. I don't even know what putting anti-cheat into the Linux kernel would involve. So I get the sentiment, but for things like the Steam Deck, I don't think it's a barrier.
All right. Well, either way, Tyler continues, Valve is stuck between a rock and a hard place with no easy solution. David Gaw writes, on Windows 11 on ARM is mostly indistinguishable from Windows 11 on Intel these days for almost everything thanks to reliable x86 emulation. The best Snapdragon PC laptops deliver solid performance in MacBook-like battery life. Parallels has supported Windows ARM on Apple Silicon for a couple years now and mostly seems fine. I run it on my M2 Pro Mini, and it's fine. It gets better Geekbench CPU scores than my circa 2021 i7-10700K gaming PC. The one area it does all fall down is, once again, gaming, thanks to that absence of high-end GPUs. So, unfortunately, it's mostly gaming, both PC and Mac, that Apple abandoned with the Apple Silicon transition.
Bunch of people wrote in to say that Windows 11 on ARM on Macs is not that terrible, and that Microsoft's latest x86 emulation thing works pretty well. So, because that's what you want. You want Windows 11 on ARM. I believe you still can't boot Macs into Windows 11 on ARM, but you can run it in virtualization, and the x86 emulation, the latest version, should make most x86 Windows applications run decently on Windows 11 on ARM on your ARM-based Mac. I'm definitely going to try that if and when I get an ARM Mac as my main Mac. I suppose I could try it now on the other computers, but they, you know, that's why my dev machine and my wife's computer, so I'm not going to mess them up too much. But I'm glad to hear that the progress is being made there. It just annoys me that, like, I mean, for extremely selfish, entirely selfish reasons, I would love it if the entire Windows PC world moved to ARM. I think Windows PC users would also enjoy it, and Microsoft is kind of trying to do that, but it's not happening very quickly. So I'm impatient to get back to the world where I was, where you could boot Windows natively or run it natively in virtualization and have all Windows software run, but the Windows world moves slowly.
So our star-crossed lovers were in the news again. Johnny Ive and Sam Altman apparently did an interview with Laureen Pell Jobs. So this is reading from Stevie Bonnefield on the Verge. Wow.
Hello. In the Verge.
On the verge of being the Verge. All right. Let me just reboot that
this
whole
is his
thing. Next. Yeah. Right. Reference acknowledged. Okay, so our star-crossed lovers are back in the news again. Johnny Ive and Sam Altman apparently did an interview together, reading from Stevie Bonnefield, who is writing for The Verge. In an interview with Laureen Powell Jobs, Sam Altman and Johnny Ive said that they are currently prototyping the first mysterious OpenAI hardware product. When asked about a time frame, Ive said it could arrive in, quote, less than, quote, 2 years. Little has been revealed so far about the OpenAI device in development, but it's rumored to be screen-free and, quote, roughly the size of a smartphone, quote. Altman described the design as simple and beautiful and playful, adding that there was an earlier prototype that we were quite excited about, but I did not have any feeling of, I want to pick up that thing and take a bite out of it. And then finally, we got there all of a sudden. Fred T. on Mastodon writes, it's definitely an egg, isn't it?
Egg.
It sounds like it.
I pulled some quotes from the rest of the interview to support the egg theory.
All right, well, let me read some selected quotes. Ive says, there's something about when the design gets so simple and beautiful and, like, playful, for lack of a better word. I mean, there's not a lot of humor in the products that are being designed and made, particularly in this area. And I really sense very clearly there's a huge desire for us not to take ourselves quite so seriously. That is pretty fucking rich coming from Johnny Ive. Good God. I like Johnny, but
you should watch his interview. The way it starts out, the pretentiousness is just over the top. I mean, in many respects earned, okay? Like, I granted it's Johnny Ive. He's not just, like, talking out of his butt like some other people we've seen in presentations, but they're so... They feel deeply and think deeply about things, or at least Johnny does, and then Sam pretends to.
When speaking of Sam, I remember in a very early meeting, Johnny said, we're going to make people smile. We're going to make people feel joy. Whatever the product does, it has to do that. And I thought, yeah, whatever, Johnny. People just want to be efficient. It's fine. But I'm so happy that Johnny pushed on that. And I didn't realize until things started to come together how much that just doesn't exist in the current set of tech companies and how lovely it is to have some whimsy back.
Eggs are whimsical.
I've said I love solutions that teeter on appearing almost naive in their simplicity, and I also love incredibly intelligent, sophisticated products that you want to touch, and you feel no intimidation, and you want to use almost carelessly, and you use them almost without thought that they're just tools.
Teetering like an egg.
Altman said, I hope that when people see it, they say, that's it. And I've said, yeah, they will.
Yeah, from this description, I actually don't think it's going to be an egg, but it is funny that lots of things that they said would fit with the egg theory. I always think of the MacBook Pros just before the current design, the last Johnny Ive MacBook Pro case design was really a very pretty case design with the tapers and everything. Not practical. You know, it made internal packaging a pain to get that outward beauty, but it did look a little bit biteable. And I feel like I'm just picturing something that's kind of like, because I'm sitting here next to me on the desk, the battery for the Vision Pro, but not shaped like that, not shaped like the sort of rounded rectangular it is, but shaped more like the last generation MacBook Pro. That would be kind of biteable. It's kind of like, I don't know how to describe it, but I can picture a shape that is about the size of a smartphone, that has no screen, that is not an egg, that is in fact biteable or looks biteable. But we'll see.
I mean, this might end up being something really great and something really amazing, but this does not fill me with confidence because the impression I've gotten so far from the Johnny and Sam Altman collaboration is that these two guys are super high on their own supply.
Oh, they are sniffing their own farts so hard.
Well,
it's
ridiculous. Johnny is on his own, and I think Sam is agreeing.
But both of them,
I think,
have a lot of that side.
Yeah,
of
I mean, he does take a lot of, again, if you watch the interview, he does take a lot of cues from Johnny's demeanor and attitude as the sort of the younger, less experienced one, right? So that relationship, it's like big dog, little dog kind of thing. And I don't doubt Johnny's sincerity. Like, I believe he believes the things he believes. I'm just not convinced that his current interests align with what will make a good product. But we'll see. You know, like, I'm not counting him up. But Sam, every time I hear him talk, I mean, I rarely watch interviews with him. I'm mostly only seeing him when he's with Johnny talking about this product. But Sam's party line that has gotten him all these gazillions of dollars of investment is disconnected with my assessment of their technology. OpenAI is great. They're the leader. Like, you know, AI stuff is great and does all sorts of wonderful things. But the way he talks about it is like, you know, it's, do you have a dragon? It's like, you don't. Like, just, you have something. It's worth a lot, right? But just, he talks about it as if it's like, and therefore, you know, suffice it to say, yada, 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 AGI. He talks about it working the way it could work, but has never worked. And so when I hear him say things like this, this interview was like defer to Johnny on design things and ask Sam about AI stuff. And he just spins out this tapestry of wonder. And it's just, all right, Sam. Okay. I just, you know, we'll see. Like, and connecting the two, it's like, if you have that, you know, again, that dragon or that genie in the bottle, whatever, it doesn't matter how awesome the egg you put it in is, like, or how crappy the egg you put it in is. If you've got that, you can put it in a toaster oven and people will love it. Like, it's, you know, it's, well, if you have that, it does not matter where it is, almost. It kind of, you know, like, just, and you don't need Johnny Ive to sell it. Whereas, can Johnny take your, you know, so-so ChatGPT caliber voice agent and make people want to use it more than they already are by putting it in a pretty egg that they want to bite? I don't think that will change things. I think millions of people are already using ChatGPT without an egg to bite. And what is the egg going to do other than like, oh, now I can carry it around with me, like my phone, but with no screen. And so I'm not sure they're barking up the right tree here, but I am fascinated to see what they produce and how the world greets it. But this is all in Sam's call. It's all on OpenAI's court, because this product lives or dies based on the thing that lives inside the biteable egg, not the egg itself.
Well, see, this is where I think I can see a possible path. Because, like, if you look at the objective path ahead of them, it's impossible. You know, the objective path ahead of them is they're trying to sell... knowing nothing about this thing yet, but they're trying to sell another device that you will carry around that is not your phone. We've seen other people try this. There was a little, like, Playdate AI thing. There was all the way up to, like, you know, the Humane IE pin. There been all these different attempts so far at, like, makes AI but hardware to augment slash compete with slash replace maybe your phone. And what we've seen over and over again is don't bet against the smartphone, because most of those things are they have a premise that people want to use their phones less, or people are tired of their phones, and that premise simply is not true. People love their phones. And so if you're trying to replace the phone and you're trying to issue a technological gadget that is going to have, you know, the great technical performance in some way, like high features, high functionality, or incredible convenience or miniaturization or whatever it is, you're probably going to lose because the smartphone is going to beat you on all those fronts. However, if you instead go the irrational appeal route, you can win there. Why did everybody buy the little Playdate of AI, which I still can't remember the name of?
The Rabbit R1.
That's it. The Rabbit. Yes. Why did everybody buy the Rabbit? It's not because they thought it was going to probably succeed. It's because it looked cool and it made them happy and it made them smile. Why didn't people buy the Humane IE pin? Because everybody at that company seemed like an out-of-touch D-bag and their thing didn't look cool.
Well, that's a strike against the Altman Ive.
Well, possibly. But I think Ive has a better chance of making something that people will be irrationally drawn to just because it's cool or it's cute or it's nice or whatever. Like, he does have a good skill in that area. And so that's an area they could, like, people could choose to buy this thing because it is just cool enough, even if it doesn't really compete on logic or specs.
But then what happened to the RapidR one? Everyone bought one because they look cool, but it turns out it didn't work very well, and so people lost interest. And that's not, I don't think that would be counted as a success if, you know, obviously the numbers would be bigger, but if, you know, if a billion people buy the biteable egg because it's they just got to have it, but then they get it and they realize, oh, this is just ChatGPT and a biteable egg, and they lose interest and go back to using it on their phone.
Well, but keep in mind, like, I think you do have a bit of a blind spot here, John, in that you kind of hate ChatGPT. Most people...
What do you mean hate ChatGPT? I use it all the time.
Most people love it. Like, most people who use it love it.
And I use it all the time.
There's hundreds of millions
today.
Of people who use it. So, okay.
I use it
so,
all the time.
Well, then, I think most people maybe like it more than you do. But the reality is, like, ChatGPT has massive consumer mind share, huge market share in terms of actual AI
use.
Yeah,
like I said, like they have a product that people already like and use, but I'm not sure what the hardware is going to bring to that.
Well, but if you take, like, they have a huge, you know, brand recognition, they have massive ability to market something because of their huge consumer brand recognition, and they're trying to make a device with Johnny Ive. So it's probably going to at least look cool. Now, whether it will actually be cool, that's a very different question, and we don't actually know that. You know, one thing we know about Johnny Ive is that he is a very good designer who benefits from a really good editor and collaborator, and Steve Jobs was a great one for him. They made such amazing things together. Then when Johnny didn't have as much editing in the Tim Cook era and he kind of got, you know, too much control and not enough pushback on things, his designs weren't as good in terms of becoming actual products. So we don't actually know what kind of collaborator Sam Altman will be for him. That actually might be a really great pairing, or it could be an awful one. We won't know until we see the kinds of things they make. But certainly Sam Altman is a different type of personality than Ive has, I think, collaborated with before. So this could kind of go in a different direction, but I can see them having a very high likelihood of making something that looks cool and that people will irrationally want to buy because it looks cool and that can be marketed very well. Now, is that going to be enough to overcome all of the, you know, headwinds against it in terms of trying to compete with the smartphone and being a whole separate thing to buy and everything? Honestly, probably not. Those are some pretty large forces against you, but maybe they can make something cool. We'll see how it goes.
I think Sam is too much of a yes man so far. Like, he really just seems to be deferring to Johnny a lot of these things rather than being an editor or his own strong force or whatever. He just thinks these fantastical things about the things he's got. We talked about this last time. They did that intro or whatever, how they were trying to say, oh, phones, you know, they take too much of our time and attention. And
don't you hate your phone? No.
Yeah. They likened using modern, not just phones, but like modern software to like walking around in Times Square where things are blinking in your face and there's lots of things that making demands of you, and they want to make a product that's more calming and chill and relaxing and not just constantly demanding stuff for you. So again, a screenless thing that you just talk to in a pleasing way. And they want it to know everything about you. What if you had a thing that knew everything about you and could help you? And like, that's why they spin off into a human level intelligent personal assistant that knows everything about you and can do all your things for you. And that doesn't exist as far as we're aware out in the outside world. And so that product that they're selling seems a bit odd. But in this particular one, Sam either forgot to stay on message or is pushing back a little bit because they kept asking him he kept mentioning the phone, and he's like, well, you know, don't get me wrong, I love my phone. And a couple of the questions like, what's the most significant product announcement? It's like, well, the iPhone is the biggest before or after product in my lifetime. And they said, what thing do you use every day that you love? And he said, well, my iPhone. So for someone who's trying to say we use our phones too much and they're too upsetting, Sam could not stop gushing about his iPhone in particular. And granted, Johnny's right there and he's buttering it up by saying the iPhone is the greatest thing ever made. And Johnny, you made this great phone and yada yada, never mind that probably the part that Sam is talking about, the big before and after moment, had less to do with the industrial design of the original iPhone and much more to do with the software that was on it, which Johnny had, I'm assuming, almost nothing to do with. But that's not on message for people use their phones too much, you should talk to our egg, right? Which was very much the pitch earlier. And I mean, again, it's only a 30-minute interview, you should watch it. There's some somewhat insufferable stuff about how wonderful San Francisco is in the beginning, but once you get through that, just see how many times Sam says that he loves his iPhone, right? Which I feel like they should be nudging about. And then Laureen Powell Jobs does her message thing, and this is like, and of course, you know, lots of that social media stuff has a lot of unintended consequences. Lots of social media, and I think she says, and other products have lots of unintended consequences. And we're like yeah, you mean like OpenAI telling people to kill themselves? Like, no one says that on stage. The three of them have three subtly different messages that they want to put out, and I wonder how something coherent is going to come out of this. But
well, it sounds like nothing coherent did.
In some ways, it is unfair to judge an unreleased product. We don't know what OpenAI's got. Like, maybe they've solved some important problem or whatever, but it just, as I've said in the past, it seems weird to me that they would wait for the egg to do that and not just, you know, put it in ChatGPT 5.1 or whatever they're doing. Oh, and by the way, a brief aside, just to give my... bona fides, or however you pronounce that, of using ChatGPT. What did I use ChatGPT for earlier today? For reasons that annoy me, one of my banks updated all of our account numbers. So anything that had any kind of like auto pay on a credit card or you got to go into all those things and enjoy finding where you can change the auto pay or delete and add a new one. Or they changed all our account numbers. The routing number is the same, but the account numbers changed. Luckily, not my business stuff, but this is personal stuff. And I was doing it, and during the course of doing it, you will encounter pages that are like, okay, you're lucky enough that we have an edit screen, which is rare. Usually they're just like, oh, delete it and make a new one. But they had an actual edit screen, and here's a text field, and it's got a bunch of like asterisks in it or something, like literal asterisks. Anyway, it's not a password field. Delete that, and I was going to paste in my new account number, because it's account number, confirm. And I had it, in a secure note, I can copy and paste it, right? Nope, copy and paste is disabled on this webpage. And I got so sick of it, and I said, ChatGPT, a webpage doesn't allow copy and paste. What can I type into the web browser's dev tool console to enable copy and paste? Because I just wanted the JavaScript code that would like stop the thing that forbids copy and paste. And ChatGPT gave me a bunch of JavaScript to put into the console, all of which I looked at and understood. Unfortunately, it did not work.
I'm surprised you're not running Stop the Madness.
Yeah, I should. Like, that's what I know. There are things that just like I was in Chrome at the time, and I know there's Chrome extensions that explicitly like I have autocomplete everywhere on that, stops websites from forbidding autocomplete. And I thought I had one that stops websites from forbidding copy and paste. And I don't know if Stop the Madness has a Chrome extension as well as a Safari extension. But anyway, I was in Chrome at the time.
There's your problem.
Yep.
No, it's not my problem. It's the reason I'm in Chrome is when I'm doing bank stuff, I have no confidence that banks' websites work in Safari, but I do have confidence they work in Chrome.
It's been a long time since I can remember going to a bank's website that didn't work in Safari.
Yeah,
but
your banks are probably better than the ones I'm dealing with. But anyway, ChatGPT, I use it every day. I know what it can do. I know what it can't do. It does not know It does not know everything about my life, nor is there a clear pathway to it knowing everything about my life forever. Like... it annoys me when he talks like that, because it's just constant vaporware. Like, and as you pointed out, Mark, it's vaporware in a situation where there are hundreds of millions of people using a product that they like, but he never wants to talk about that. He wants to talk about the product that doesn't exist, that would be cool if it did exist. And I agree, it would be cool, but how about just concentrating on the product that you've got and make that one better? And they are, to be fair, they do make it better by bits and bits, but there's a gap there. There's a hype gap between what he talks about and the products his company is shipping.
Ain't no there. All right, with regard to the Apple N1 Wi-Fi chip, apparently it makes the older Broadcom chips look kind of stinky. Andrew Cunningham at Ars writes, Ookla, the folks behind the speed test app and website, have analyzed about 5 weeks' worth of users' testing data to get an idea of how the iPhone 17 lineup stacks up to the iPhone 16, as well as the Android phones with Wi-Fi chips from Qualcomm, MediaTek, and others. While the N1 isn't at the top of the charts, Ookla says that Apple's Wi-Fi chip, quote, delivered higher download and upload speeds on Wi-Fi compared to the iPhone 16 across every studied percentile and virtually every region, quote. Ookla noted that the N1's best performance seemed to improve scores most of all in the bottom 10th percentile performance tests, implying Apple's custom silicon lifts the floor more than the ceiling. The iPhone 17 also didn't top Ookla's global performance charts. Ookla found that the Pixel 10 Pro series slightly edges out the iPhone 17 download speed, while a Xiaomi 15T Pro with MediaTek Wi-Fi silicon featured better upload speeds.
Still, that's pretty good. We spent all this time talking about how are their cell chips doing? Oh, they're not as good as Qualcomm, blah, blah, blah. But mostly for the N1, we're like, well, I hope it just works. But it turns out that it is better than was in the iPhone 16. So good job, and presumably uses less power. So good job, Apple, on the N1. It's testing very well.
Several weeks ago, we were thinking about why the cameras are situated the way they are in the back of the phone and thinking, oh, maybe they could be separated or whatever the case may be. And Anonymous, amongst many other people, wrote, maybe the triangle camera cluster helps keep a stable perspective when switching lenses as the user zooms in. If the physical sensors were spread across the width of the Pro Max, there would be a jarring jump when moving from 1X to 4X. This might also help fusion processing.
I think we brought this up in the past while talking about the stovetop burners, but yeah, it's worth remembering. I still think it's worth it. Like, yes, it will jump. It jumps now. It will jump more if they separated them. It's not the end of the world. Like, tons of other phones do it. The distances are not. It's not like going from inches to feet. It is just, you know, less than a centimeter to 1 or 2 centimeters. So I think it's worth it, and I think they should do it, but this would be one of the trade-offs.
All right, and then speaking of bringing out your dead, the UK still wants an iCloud backdoor. Reading from 9to5Mac from October, the Financial Times reports that the British government did indeed withdraw its initial worldwide order, but it has now replaced it with another one applying only to its own citizens. The Financial Times says UK government has issued a new order to Apple to create a backdoor into its cloud storage service, this time targeting only British users' data. Back to 9to5Mac, the White House has suggested at the time that Britain was completely abandoning its attempt to force Apple's hand. Now that it has obtained protection for U.S. iCloud users, however, it seems that pressure has been removed. Financial Times continues, members of the U.S. delegation raised the issue of the request to Apple around the time of Trump's visit, according to two people briefed on the matter. However, two senior British government figures said the U.S. administration was no longer leaning on the U.K. government to rescind the order. Boo.
Disappointed to be exactly right to doubt the previous government statements about this and to also doubt their follow through. But there you have it. They declared victory when there was none, and the UK government still wants something stupid. And so I'm not sure what Apple's going to do here, but I don't think they're going to be any more particularly inclined to backdoor iCloud just for UK citizens.
Well, let's do some topics. Apparently, Apple Fitness Plus is under review.
Yeah, I put this in here because the Mac Pro, you got all this fun about my Mac Pro potentially going bye-bye. Mm-hmm. Well, now it's your turn, Casey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Gurman writes, Fitness Plus, the company's app-based Peloton rival, remains one of its weakest digital offerings. The $10 a month service suffers from high churn and offers little revenue upside. Still, Fitness Plus has enough loyalty from its small fan base, that Apple can't simply shut it down without a backlash. And given how inexpensive it is to operate, there's little incentive for a nearly $4 trillion company to pull the plug, especially if such move would generate negative headlines. That said, the future of Fitness Plus is under review. The division is getting new management, with Apple Health head Sumbul Desai adding Fitness Plus to her portfolio. But both she and the group that now reports serves as Chief Eddie Q, both she and that group will now report to serves as Chief Eddie Q. With that new arrangement in place, the service will be under fresh pressure to improve results.
You better do more workouts, Casey. You want to keep that service around.
Yeah, you know, I haven't used Fitness Plus in a while, which is kind of damning given the support, but I do really, really enjoy it. I really honestly do. And typically, as I've said many times in the past, there's a service called Beachbody. Now it's called Body. It's terrible. Yeah, I know. It was basically an MLM, which they've largely abandoned that as far as I'm aware. And you don't have to get involved in the MLM part. You can just get the fitness videos and eschew the supplements and the pre-workout and all that other junk that was really gross. And that's what, you know, Aaron and I always did. And their workout videos I really enjoy, and typically Aaron and I will go back and forth going through several programs that they have. And I really like Body, again, nay, Beachbody. And usually after I finish like an 8-week program on that, I'll do a couple of weeks of Fitness Plus to kind of like have a palate cleanser. And I really enjoy Fitness Plus. I think it's really, really, really good. But I will be sad, if not surprised, if it goes away. And it wouldn't surprise me if it goes away.
There's also some news that CNN was pulling out of News Plus because they've got their own pay offering for news stuff.
Yeah, I did see that flyby.
Like, yeah, News Plus is, Fitness Plus makes perfect sense to me. Like, it's sad that maybe not enough people are using it or whatever, but it seems like a very Apple-style fitness offering with no real bad parts about it. If you like what they're offering, like, it, you know, it's part of a bundle. I'm not sure. Can you buy it separately? Anyway.
Yeah, it's $10 a month.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it seems fine. News Plus, on the other hand, has always seemed weird and un-Apple-like because it's filled with terrible ads and the app isn't very good. And it's that it's in that, you know, thing we talked about last week of Apple not really being known as a web-first company. So News Plus is an app that lets you read things that are also available on the web, but you're not really reading them on the web, but there are Apple News URLs, so you can read them on the web, but it will launch the app, and it's just, what are you, Apple? And then the terrible ads. Like, what are you doing? And then losing CNN. Like, I still appreciate News Plus for the purposes of this show because I've subscribed to the Apple One bundle. Otherwise, I wouldn't get News Plus. But it lets me read, like, the Wall Street Journal without subscribing to the Wall Street Journal because they get the Wall Street Journal articles. But even that is such a weird dance of, like, you know, find the Wall Street Journal article, it's behind a paywall, and then use the share sheet to open an Apple News, which isn't available. And I think it's not available in the in-app browser, but it is available in Safari. Anyway, it's confusing and annoying, but it does let me read things that I otherwise would have to pay separately for, so I appreciate that. But every time I look at Apple News Plus, I'm like, I can't believe people would open this. This would be like their main news source, because it's filled with all the worst ads that you see on the web. And that's not Apple-like. But Fitness Plus is Apple-like. It's just, I don't know, someone pointed out in the chat room, fitness services surely have a lot of churn because, you know, people are dedicated to working out and then, you know, fall out of the habit and then go back and forth, you know. So, but it's, I mean, it's the type of thing, this is the thing that always annoys me about Apple or the current Apple anyway. Like, let's say, you know, they don't put numbers behind this or whatever, but you might think, oh, well, as long as the money that it brings in exceeds the money that it costs to run it, they'll keep doing it. But that's not the way a company the Apple size seems to think, which is it's not worth our time unless it's going to make us this amount of profit. Merely being profitable is not sufficient to stay alive, which, you know, again, I think certain things you should do because you think they're an important part of your product portfolio. I'm not getting to the Mac Pro, but just like Apple Fitness Plus seems like an offering that fits in with their online service offering, and it is very Apple-like and clean and doesn't have anything gross in it and is a good version of the thing that it's trying to be. So as long as it's, even if it was losing a little bit of money or breaking even, I would still keep doing it. But I will also be disappointed it goes away, despite the fact that I've never done Apple Fitness Plus and it doesn't appeal to me at all. I just think it's a good example of what it's trying to be.
Yeah, and just very, very, very quickly, what I like about it is, first of all, the trainers are, you know, the bubbly, happy Apple trainers you would expect. Like, they're men and women, they're all different shapes and sizes, and they're really, really enjoyable. And they're not all American. There's a bunch of Brits. I'm pretty sure there's other nationalities as well that I'm not thinking of. But they're really, really good at what they do. Additionally, one of the things I like about it is the integration. So if you have an Apple Watch, then your rings will show, assuming you're doing a workout on your Apple TV, your rings will show right there on the TV and update live as you're doing your workout. So you can watch your green and your red rings close, which is really nice. Additionally, if you pause the workout on your watch, it will pause playback on the TV, which is really neat. Is this earth-shattering? Absolutely not. But it's neat, and I like it. And again, the workouts you can do, like a 5-minute core up to, I think they might have a 40-minute something or other, but they have up to like 30-minute HIIT and strength workouts. And I really like them. I haven't done them in a few months now, but I really do like them, and I really think they're really, really well done. They're very pretty to look at. They're nicely executed. They're accomplishable by people of varying fitness levels, and they always have one person that's like, not remedial, but, you know, not working quite as strenuously. I really do think it's really well executed, and I would be sad if it went away.
And honestly, like, it seems like, I guess, I don't know how strong of a position Apple's services are in besides the taxes and fees. Like, are people absolutely running to the other ones? Maybe. It seems like Apple TV Plus, now it's called Apple TV. it seems like TV is seemingly, I think, doing pretty well.
Yeah, I don't know if TV makes money, but it does make headlines. They won Oscar, they win Emmys. It buffs the brand.
And you can go
whether
for, like,
or not it makes money.
Yeah, and like the other services that we like, the other kind of content services, News Plus, Arcade, and then Fitness, I don't think they do that much. Like, we almost never hear about them. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, but like, we don't hear that much about them. But I think it's important for Apple, if they're trying to sell their bundle and their subscription, what they're trying to say is, hey, everybody, come sign up for Apple One and you get all this cool stuff. Look at all this cool stuff you get. And I think in that context, having a fitness service is actually more important then how many people actually end up using the fitness service? So even if not that many people are using it, I hope Apple can see, like, in the bigger picture, it's nice. First of all, that's a very aspirational thing. A lot of people,
like a gym membership.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you
a lot
have to
of
use
people
it, just got to pay for it.
Exactly. And a lot of people will pay for it because they're like, yeah, you know what? If I spend the extra $6 a month to get this whole bundle compared to the pieces I was going to buy separately, I'll get these few other things. And yeah, maybe I will start using fitness. Yeah, that sounds good.
I mean,
not
this week, but next week maybe.
Right, sometime. But that still helps the bundle overall sell. And it helps Apple show, like, here's a broad selection of different services. And when you look at, like, what does it cost them to keep it going? They've already built out the studios. They've already set everything up. They've already built the software. They've already built it all. The actual cost of them to keep it going is trivial, you know, especially for Apple. Like, it's trivial. So I hope that they can see in the big picture, like, having this service, even if it doesn't get amazing numbers of direct usage, it does provide a net benefit that might be bigger than that. And it's costing very little to keep it going. So I'd say keep it going. But
yeah, hard agree.
That's why I don't work at Apple. So who knows?
And they are cheap. If they're anything,
yes,
they're cheap.
Very, very cheap. You don't usually get that rich without being that cheap.
Yep. All right. There was a very interesting video that went around a couple of weeks ago, I think. Fast charging and battery degradation. So HTX Studio tried to answer the question, is fast charging killing the battery? A 2-year test on 40 phones. And so Julie Clover and Mac Rumors summarized it. Using 6 iPhone 12 models, the channel set up a system to drain batteries from 5% and charge them to 100% over and over again. 3 were fast charged and 3 were slow charged. Another set of iPhones underwent the same test, but with charging initiated at 30%, stopped at 80%. So the iPhones were always in that range. This was done, I forget the specific hardware they used, but they had a combination of hardware and software that would work together to have the phone tell the hardware, I need to be charged now or stop charging me. It was very, very, very clever how this was done. Anyway, going back to Julie, the results suggest there's minimal additional battery drain from fast charging, but keeping an iPhone between 30% and 80% charge could be minimally beneficial.
It's such a weird way to test this, you know, because it's kind of like, I guess you would describe it as like integration testing or system testing, because they're charging phones, as you noted, like automating the charging phones. But like the battery manufacturers know how the batteries perform. Like they, you know, this lithium ion battery manufacturers are well aware of the, limits of their batteries and how they behave under various scenarios and whether fast charging and slow charging and yada yada. Like that's their job done. But that's just a battery in isolation. So they're testing the whole system. Well, you don't care how the battery performs. You care how your phone performs. And the phone is the battery and the thing that converts the voltage and the charging system and the software and the operating system and the case and the heat dissipation and like a million other variables. So they're trying to test that at the system level. But even there, it's like, okay, well, where were these phones while they were being charged? Were they in your pocket? Were they in your jacket pocket? Were they on your nightstand? Like, how cold was the weather? Like, it's all sorts of other variables that affect your phone when you're charging it. Is it in a sunbeam while it's charging because you put it on your kitchen countertop? Like, there's so much. But, like, they're just sort of rediscovering the same things that the battery manufacturer could have told them, which is that fast charging is not as good as slow charging because the difference isn't that big. And the battery manufacturers, I'm sure, pride themselves on narrowing that gap further and further because they want to sell a battery to phone makers that can tolerate fast charging without hurting the battery. Like, they want to be able to charge fast. They want to be able to discharge fast. They want to be able to do a lot of cycles without losing capacity. That's how battery manufacturers compete with each other. And this is just sort of proving that out with modern phones of saying, yep, fast charging hurts the battery more, but the gap isn't that big. And, the conclusion of the video is what we always say about this, which is like, unless you really need to pinch those pennies on resale and you think your battery life is going to affect it, just use your phone. Just use your phone how you're going to use your phone. How you use your phone is how your battery is going to turn out. If you constantly use it, you know, you charge it in your pocket, you do MagSafe charging instead of a wire, you fast charge all the time, then that's how you have to use your phone. And that means your phone's battery is going to be in worse condition after 2 years than it wouldn't have been otherwise. But, like, what's the alternative? To change your entire life around babying the battery? Just use your phone how you're going to use your phone. You can be aware, you know, if you're a tech nerd, you can be aware of the things that batteries like and don't like. But I don't think it's worth changing your life to satisfy the battery. The phone's job is to be a tool for you, not the other way around.
Hello, Future Marco.
Hi.
Do we want to do future iPhone plans? Do we want to just go to Ask ATP? How do you feel?
I think probably Ask ATP.
I was kind of leaning that way too, but John, any conflicting thoughts?
I mean, that's fine.
We haven't done
it, especially if we're gonna have. Do you think the after show is gonna be long?
Maybe 15 minutes.
I think it's fine personally to go to Ask ATP, but that's also because the more you ask me, the more I'm going to die.
So maybe what's the fourth one? Ask ATP. We can even do a fourth question. Ask ATP if we have time. So,
all right. Okay, we haven't done Ask ATP in like 34 years, so we're going to do some Ask ATP, and we're going to start with Max Velasco Knott, who writes, Marco, now that you run a restaurant and have a staff, has that affected your tipping culture or tipping preferences, etc., when you dine at other restaurants?
No, because I was already tipping pretty well. That's so. Here's the thing: if you the way tips work in restaurants, in America, yes, good qualification. workers in restaurants usually are paid below minimum wage as their base salary because they're expected to make more in tips. And then that should push them well above the minimum wage in a good restaurant and hopefully at least above it in, you know, kind of a slow, inexpensive one maybe. But anyway, these people are on their feet constantly. When you are a server at a restaurant, you generally don't stop moving during your shift. You are constantly moving. It is a hard job, and if you're a good person, you kind of have also the burden that you have to bring up the average from the bad people. So this includes both, you know, people who don't tip very well, which there are a lot of them, and people who are just kind of jerks. So my goal in a service situation like this is not to necessarily be super noticed. Just, I want to make sure that I'm doing what I can to make this person's day a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of people doing the opposite. So my goal is always, you know what? I'm going to be an easy customer. I'm not going to give them too much of a hard time about anything. Because also keep in mind, too, like the kinds of things servers get blamed for or praised for oftentimes are not the fault in either direction. Because the server is like the face of the restaurant to the customer for the most part. Like that's the server is usually the only employee that most customers are interacting with, or maybe a host up front for a minute, and the server is the rest of it. And so the server gets the blame or the praise for everything. Now, the praise, great, you know, good for them. But they also will get the blame for things like if the food is slow to come out, which is not their fault usually. Usually it's like, you know, things get really busy. Maybe the kitchen's backed up a little bit. Or, you know, if the food tastes good, that's also not the server's fault either direction, you know? Or, you know, just other things like servers get a lot of people who, you know, blame them a lot or are rude to them, treat them like subservient humans. Like there's a lot of people who are rude or worse to restaurant staff. And so I like to go the opposite direction. So I've always been nice and polite. Even when I had no money, I've always been nice and polite and an easy customer. Even back like in high school, I would still tip reasonably. You know, I wouldn't, even when I had not that much, if I couldn't afford the tip, I wouldn't go to the restaurant. So that's kind of been my philosophy all the time. Now, as I've gotten older and I've gotten more money, I've been able to tip better. So even before we own the restaurant, I consider it's kind of like in a very, very small form of altruism. I consider that life has been very good to me and I like to leave a nice tip because it seems like paying it forward. It's like, hey, you know what? Life's been very good to me. I kind of got lucky. I'm going to try to give this person some of that luck, make their day a little bit better. So I will leave a ridiculous tip if I can, and that's usually the case. And so I'll go 50% maybe for like a restaurant I like a lot, or like unless it's like, you know, $1,000, right? That might be a little crazy, but like, you know, I'll tip well, and I'm lucky that I can do that. For those of you out there who can tip well, I suggest you do, because chances are, if you have that kind of resources yourself, chances are giving that money to the server, they'll make better use of it than you will. It'll mean more to them than it means to you. And you're making the world a little bit better place, and you're making up a lot for all the people who don't do that, because it's a tough job. They really work their butts off, and I think it's the right thing to do if you can do it.
Yep, couldn't agree more. John, any thoughts to add?
No, I mean, I don't go out to restaurants that much, but I tend to tip like pragmatically for like delivery food. I tip with the urgency of me wanting these places to stay in business. I guess it maybe this started during like, you know, the COVID lockdown. It's like my tipping became much more generous. I was tipping fine before, but like now, you know, like macro level tips, because it's like, I don't want you to go out of business because you're close by to my house. You just opened. You're close by to my house. You deliver to my address. You're prompt. Your food is good. I don't know how many other people are going there.
Well,
so hopefully
the tip
this will
is not
keep going
to the restaurant in that case. You know that, right?
Well, no, these are places that deliver themselves. They're not using like DoorDash or whatever. Like,
oh, okay.
Some places actually have their own delivery. It's hard to believe, but in the place that I live, some places have their own. We just had some of it tonight. Their actual own delivery where people, probably the kids of the people who own the restaurant, deliver whatever. But it's takeout. Like, there's like, what are you tipping for? There's a delivery fee. Like, they do charge a delivery fee, but there's also a place for a tip. And I tip like I was at a sit-down restaurant, and I tip, you know, basically saying, please stay around. This one sandwich place. I keep trying to do that, but they're never open when I want a sandwich. I'm like, I can't buy things from you if you're not open. I don't know how long that place is for this world, but I like their sandwiches. So, yeah, that's the only thing. I think COVID lockdown has probably changed my tipping culture to be extremely generous tipping for people I'd never see in person on top of the delivery fee for delivery food.
Eric Jacobson writes, what do you think about using third-party packages in your apps? I know Marco tries to use packages rarely, if at all, a stance that I find admirable, but not exactly pragmatic. Callsheet doesn't strike me as something that would need many, but we've all worked on enough apps to know that unexpected needs are the rule. Hyperspace, on the other hand, I'm sure could benefit from all sorts of outside work. I'm not entirely sure how Eric jumped to those conclusions. I'll start by saying Callsheet has... I should have had the project open. I don't know. So I'll go off the top of my head. Callsheet has a couple of third-party projects. There's a Socket project that I use for talking to Plex. And then I just this week adopted Swift. It's a first-party project, but it's one that you have to bring in using Swift Package Manager. It's not async algorithms, which is kind of like combine meets async await, but there's another one that Apple does wherein they have different data structures, and I needed an orderable dictionary for something that's coming out fairly soon. And so I pulled that in recently, but that's, I think, it. I don't think I'm using anything else. Marco, you have some pretty strong stances about this. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I pitched you, Marco, let me interrupt myself. I don't necessarily have
only
anything
you
against...
would apologize for interrupting yourself.
Well, I told you you were up, and then I said I was a liar. So anyway, I don't really have anything against third-party code, but generally speaking, I've come to land on Marco's side of things, which is I avoid it if reasonably possible. Not because I think my code is necessarily better or anything like that, but I feel like having 100% ownership over everything that happens in the app is something to aspire to the degree that you can using Swift UI and UIKit, so on and so forth. And so generally speaking, if I can just write whatever I need to write, and especially if I have any interest in writing the thing I want to write, generally speaking, I'll just do that. Now, I could have written a orderable dictionary, but I didn't have any interest in it, and it wouldn't have really served any useful purpose. And since it was a first party project, I thought, hey, I'll just suck that in. But generally speaking, I'm not an absolutist about it, but I do generally try to avoid it now. Now, Marco, for real this time, what are your thoughts?
I obviously, like as discussed before, like I do try to avoid using third-party code in my app. Mostly, it's you know, it comes from experience of third-party code having bitten me in the butt much of the time that I have used it. Not all the time. And I'm not 100% against it, but the barrier is high. It has to be really worth it, and not using it has to be really bad. So for instance, I will discuss it for in a few minutes. I'm going to be talking about how I had to switch an S3 compatible provider to a different S3 compatible provider on Overcast backend. And I write my own S3 PHP accessing class. I wrote it a few years back. I believe I even posted it to GitHub as a gist or something. But I wrote it a few years back because I just needed some kind of like S3 compatible basic IO library, and everything out there for PHP that I could find was these, like, you know, usually the official Amazon one or some third party one that's just like this absolutely massive, giant library with hundreds of files, all this complexity that I didn't really need. And I know, like, you know, for me to do this myself, I know it's not that much code. I think doing it myself was something like 200 lines of code. Like, it was not a lot of code. And it's fine. And just literally a few, like 2 weeks ago, I had to look at that code and be like, all right, I have to modify it slightly to be compatible with this other service. Is this worth it to me? And you know what? It really was unpleasant for about 2 hours. And then I found what I was doing slightly wrong, that one service tolerated and the other service didn't, and I fixed it. And now it's fine. And now I won't have to touch that code again for years. And meanwhile, that code, because it's so small, and I've written it entirely myself, number one, it is just lighter on the servers. It will literally directly save me money over time. Number two, I know it. So if any part of it has to change, or if I have to debug a problem, I know all the code, and it's small enough that even if I have to look at it again, you know, 3 years from now, when I've definitely, you know, it has definitely fallen out of my L3 cache by then in my mind, but I'll be able to look at it and figure it out really fast because it's small. So that's the kind of benefit that I tend to go for when I have a library that, like, I could use someone else's, or I can write my own. Now, sometimes the complexity is not worth it. So, like, the main third-party library I use on the servers is the Stripe API, because dealing with, like, you know, Stripe stuff, like, I know I don't offer Stripe subscriptions for the app, but I do use Stripe to sell my ads on the website. And dealing with Stripe for that, like, it's super easy to use their API and for me to use their SDK, rather, and for me to not use their PHP SDK would be a decent amount of work with the feature set that I use. Now, I could do it, but I don't need to. It's fine. And that's something that's like Stripe has proven over time that their SDK is very trustworthy and very low needs. I don't, like, one thing I would not enjoy is if the copy of it that I had needed to be updated frequently. So far, I forget when I built my Stripe ad system. I think it was something like 8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that. I think I've had to update the code once in that entire time. And so again, this is like, it's a low needs library. It's a high cost to do it myself, and I've never had any problems with it. So I'm okay doing that. But that has not been the case for things like S3 libraries or things like, you know, a lot of the iOS side stuff. And frankly, on the iOS side, I really don't frequently have a need for third-party code. Usually the kind of code I'm writing on the iOS side is custom code that only I could write, because it's like it's integrating stuff in within my app to other stuff within my app. I don't have a lot of these like orthogonal problems that I can have one library import to totally solve a problem for me. I don't have a lot of that. And if I for some reason need something smaller, like, you know, give me a function to calculate the tangent between, you know, these two triangle points, I'll just ask ChatGPT and I'll look at the 10 lines of code that it wrote. I'll adapt them so they fit and work. And then it's a 10 line function. So, like, I don't have a lot of needs for things that are larger than that a third party library might even exist for.
John.
I come from the web development world, and ever since the web had any libraries at all to speak of, they have constituted the vast majority of the code. Like, even if you think back in the jQuery days, you'd throw jQuery and then write a paragraph of code. Well, jQuery is way more than a paragraph of code. It always has been. And I know they try to minify themselves and make them small, but the fact is that, you know, client-side web libraries have grown. Server-side web libraries. I've written tons of web frameworks in Perl in my career. Even when I'm using a framework that I wrote myself, still the vast majority of the code is third-party code because of CPAN, the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, one of the original package management open source things. you know, I would build my web frameworks on top of libraries, on top of C-band modules, because that's just the way things were done. So both client-side and server-side in the web, libraries made up the vast majority of code. That's not that different from the world on Apple platforms. It's just we think of it differently because it's like, well, there's the operating system, and there's all the frameworks that lead up to the pinnacle framework, which is UIKit or AppKit or whatever. But underneath that is frameworks on top of frameworks on top of frameworks on top of libraries on top of the operating system. None of that is your code, but it's first-party code. It's not third-party. But anyway, the vast majority of the code that makes up, quote-unquote, your app is almost certainly not your code. It's, you know, the operating system and the frameworks, even though it's all first party. So I'm very used to the idea that what I'm doing is writing on top of a mountain of someone else's code. I did enjoy my career as a web developer having the source code to all of that code that I'm writing on top of, which is not true on Apple platforms. You have some of the source code, but not all of it, which is disappointing. But all that is to say, I am not allergic to using libraries. That said, part of the reason we like Apple's platforms is the first-party stuff on frameworks provides you a lot of stuff. So you're like, it's not like it is in, you know, Perl or, you know, to make the extreme case, like Node.js, where doing almost anything requires importing a hajillion libraries, right? You can just start a project and use UIKit or AppKit or SwiftUI or whatever. Just use that first-party top-level framework and do a lot of stuff without ever having to go anywhere to a third-party thing. That said, my apps do have third-party stuff. Again, I'm not quite sure why Hyperspace got the call out for a thing that's going to need third-party libraries. The only third-party libraries that you even use in Hyperspace, one library is for, I don't know if you've looked at the UI, but I do like a thing that imitates like the path bar in the Finder, kind of, where it shows like the, I had to represent a folder hierarchy without, I didn't want to use a path with slashes because that's not user-friendly if you're not Unix. So like, how does macOS do it in the Finder? It shows like, you know, a folder icon, a folder name, and then like a little, you know, arrow or whatever. Like, I don't know. What do you call it? Is it called the path bar? There's, I don't know so. What it's called in the Finder, but they show you a path without making it a Unix path. So I wanted to make a thing that did that. And that requires, you know, making a little image and some text and doing truncation and doing wrapping of the images and the text with truncation. And I wanted to do a thing where if you moused over the truncated ones, it would expand them so you could see the full name on them, and it has to flow correctly and overflow if it gets too big. And that's a fairly complicated thing. And I implemented that all myself. And it wasn't fun in SwiftUI to do that. And then after I implemented myself, I forget if it was after 1.0, but I think it was, I found a third-party library that did exactly that. I'm like, oh, thank God. Because it wasn't
nice.
I'm not a SwiftUI expert. And yeah, I got it to work and it was fine, but I am more than happy to use a third party, you know, Swift Package Manager package that does reflowable like collections. And honestly, Apple really needs to up their SwiftUI game to sort of reach parity with like UIKit and AppKit with like their collection views, you know. SwiftUI does not have very robust collection views. That would make my life a lot easier if they did it. But anyway, there's a library called Flow that's on GitHub that I used, and I ripped. That was glorious. It deleted all my code, all my stupid custom view layout thing or whatever, and just imported that package and used it. That's a UI thing. The other main library I use in Hyperspace is a library to implement the Easter egg. There's a Hyperspace-themed Easter egg that does some fun graphics. And I didn't want to write myself. And there's a third-party library from a well-known Swift developer, teacher in the Swift community who did like a fun library to do fun graphics. I will gladly use that library instead of rolling that by myself. That's it. All of the stuff that touches files, that's all my code on top of Apple's frameworks, Unix APIs, all that other stuff. So no frameworks for any of the actual functionality, just a framework for UI layout and a framework for an Easter egg. And then in SwitchGlass, actually in all of these, I'd use, well, not in Hyperspace, because Hyperspace does an app purchase because it's free download, but SwitchGlass is paid up front. And this always annoyed me once I discovered this with Mac development. If you do a paid up front Mac app and you just write it naively, your app does nothing to make sure that someone actually paid for it. You have to write some code. I thought this, you got this for free as part of the Mac App Store.
Nope.
You have to write some code that says, oh, and by the way, when you're running, make sure someone didn't just copy this to another machine. Like, make sure it actually is downloaded from the Mac App Store. And does Apple provide code for you to do that? Not really. not in a good way. And so there are third-party libraries that will check to see that you have the Mac App Store receipt and that it's valid and signed and so on and so forth. And those third-party libraries have to keep pace with all whatever Apple does. Oh, we're changing the algorithm. We use a different hash or whatever. I don't want to have to deal with that. So I just use a library. Again, it's an open source library that does receipt validation on macOS. And I use that to make it so that my app cannot be naively copied into another Mac and run in my paid upfront app. Obviously, with Hyperspace, where it's in-app purchase, the whole in-app purchase system handles that. But yeah, Apple should definitely do a better job there. But I use that package in SwitchGlass, and then it in turn uses other packages that are also open source, like Swift Crypto and stuff like that. Anyway, so that's what I use in my Apple apps. But I'm not allowed to do third party code. I think of it very much like Marco does, where it's like, do I want to deal with this? Is this going to change often? And you know, the reason I gave the layout example is like, even if I've already written all the code for it, is that code like the core competency of my app? No, it's just something. It's just a layout that it's a layout that I want to have that I don't even have to have. I could pick a different layout. I just wanted to have that one. But I'm not the value of my app doesn't rely on, wow, look at this great layout code he wrote. No, I will gladly use a library for that. And then I will be praying for the day when Apple sort of Sherlocks that library and says, oh, you don't need that library anymore because we built it into Swift UI. And then I'll be able to delete that dependency and just use Apple's first party implementation.
Nice. All right. Nathan writes, I've been thinking about the subfolders in the applications folder, and I'm curious about your thoughts. I know it might seem a bit unconventional, but I've noticed some apps acting strangely, others refusing to launch, and some just refuse to budge from the root of the applications folder. I use Spotlight and Alfred, but I've always felt like my applications folder could be more organized and user-friendly. It's like a cluttered mess that I'm constantly wishing to tidy up. Have you ever tried organizing your applications folder in subfolders? What have you found to be the benefits and drawbacks? Has this ever been a thing on the Mac? Or should I just give up and pretend it's not there? This is something I have never once thought about, do not think about, will not think about, do not care about. Just stop worrying about it, Nathan. You have many other things to worry about. Stop worrying about this.
You can answer the question. Has this ever been a thing on a Mac? Yes, it absolutely has. Cue the line that I cannot remember from the intro from the Fellowship of the Ring movie. Something, something, things were lost because none now live who remember them. I'm still alive. I remember. I used to arrange all my applications into beautifully arranged subfolders with their own custom icons in classic macOS. Because in classic macOS, the computer belonged to the user, as did the file names. You could name things whatever you wanted. You could put them, mostly, wherever you wanted, with exceptions of certain things having to do with the operating system. That freedom was lost in the transition to macOS 10. Apple tried to do the best they could. Do applications have to be in applications, the applications folder? Well, no. Obviously, Apple itself ships the utilities folder. Inside the applications folder is a folder called utilities, and inside there are applications. Also, you can make an applications folder in your home directory, which is so well supported that it will get a little application folder badge because Apple knows that it's going to be there against this holdover from the next days when you can have local applications, user applications, network applications, so on and so forth. So there are a bunch of designated OK spots for applications, and Apple itself has subfolders in the application folders that they put applications in. There's also things in system library core services. There's applications in lots of different places. But as Casey was expressing in his Casey way, the culture on macOS 10 is that applications go in the applications folder. And Apple encourages you to do this in various ways in the UI. If you ever tried to run an application from like a disk image or run it from the downloads folder, sometimes the applications themselves will say, hey, I notice you're running me from not in the applications folder. Do you want movie there? And I think there's an OS feature that will like translocate them there and say, hey, I'm not running an application. Do you want me to move me there? Should it make a difference where they are? Not really. But I mean, running them from disk image is bad because disk images are read-only, but these days applications shouldn't be writing things to their own bundles, but who knows what happens. But anyway, what has happened is that the culture on macOS of applications just expecting to be in the applications folder has produced a brood of applications, many of which don't behave correctly when they're not in the applications folder. I think that is antisocial and bad. I think applications should behave just fine when they're on the applications folder. And if they have to be in there for some good explicable reason, they should notice when they're not running there and offer to move themselves there. But that should be a very rare edge case. Otherwise, they should, like most of Apple's applications, run from anywhere. again, system library core services. Like, it's not a special special folder. They should run from anywhere. So I think it's bad that they can't, but some of them do get cranky when they run outside there. Now, if you want to subdivide, I do have some subfolders. Like, I have a games subfolder in my applications folder, and in there are a bunch of games. They're all fine. They all run fine from there. Sometimes I have subfolders within subfolders. Like, most applications will be fine. But if you're nervous at all, or you have any application that looks like it's misbehaving, put it into the top-level applications folder. I've never had anything misbehave in my home directory's applications folder. So take that for what you will. Maybe because that's more of a blessed location. But, yeah, it's bad. It used to be better. There used to be more flexibility. But most people don't care where their applications are and don't want to organize them. And so if you're having any problems, just stick it in applications.
Marco, do you also organize your applications folder?
Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even open my applications folder.
Yeah, same. I almost never do.
It's all from search.
Yep.
All right. Do you want to do maybe like one more? We're a little short.
Let me try that again. Omri Arbiv writes, I recall an old Hypercritical episode in which John said he will always be better than his children in video games. Now that John's children are in college, is there any video game that either of them plays better than John? Have Marco or Casey's kids surpassed their video game skill? Let's start with me and Marco and end with John on this one, because I think John will have most to say. For me, I can no longer consistently beat Declan in Mario Kart. That's the only thing that we play semi-regularly together. We haven't played in a while, though, to be honest. More often than not, I can beat him, but there's a handful of tracks that he's better than me on. I forget which one's off the top of my head, but generally speaking, I can still whip his butt. Marco, how's it going with Adam in that department?
There are some games that I am better than him at, typically games that rely on old platform game mechanics in the 2D world that we grew up in. There's a game... I can't even think of the name right now. We were just playing it. It's a game where... Chat room, help me out. It's a game where you, like... It's 2D, and you, like, set traps. Chicken Horse... Oh, God, what the heck is that game called? Ultimate Chicken Horse. Okay. So, Adam and I play a game called Ultimate Chicken Horse that is basically, like... It's, like, a new party... Well, new to me. It's probably, like, 15 years old. But, like, it's, like... It's a modern kind of, like, 2D side-scrolling party game where you, like, jump through, like, difficult scenarios that you make up in a 2D platformy kind of world. I play that with a Super Nintendo-style controller, and I'm really good at it. And I can beat him much of the time in that game. Not all the time, but much of the time in that game. That's it. In all other games, he's way better than me. Like, not even in the same league. So far ahead of me. But in that kind of game that relies on, like, old platform mechanics, that I'm actually good at that. So that I can do. But those, like, anything else, anything involving, like, certainly combat, I mean, forget it. I don't stand a chance. But he's just so much, you know, because he's, in general, in life... He's just much faster than me. Like, his brain works a lot faster than mine. And he is so, you know, tuned in to video games and how to play video games. And, like, he will spend hours getting good at them and building the skills and getting the muscle memory. And, like, so he is starting from a better place already, because he's not only younger than me, but he's mentally faster and physically faster than me. But then also, he has so much practice with the games, and he'll go and do the research, and he'll watch the YouTube videos, and he'll dive into all the stuff. And so, like, any game that we play, he will know everything about it before I've even seen it. So I don't stand a chance in most games. Now, we do play games together anyway. Like we generally like playing games that are, you know, maybe more co-op style, or games that are so simple, like Ultimate Chicken Horse, that it doesn't really matter. But we can do things like, you know, we've played, like, the Bloons TD games together, where just as co-op, we're both playing, like, the same team, just trying to beat the big mobs of whatever coming into the tower defense arena. But yeah, if we're actually playing against each other, he's better than me in every possible way.
All right, John, what's the situation?
I don't remember if I said this on the Hypercritical episode, but I hope I did, which is...
I was going to say, it sounds like you.
Yeah, no, not that. This particular thing I'm about to say. I did definitely say that I was going to always be better than you. But I don't remember if I explained something that would have helped you two, which is that... as you get older and your kids get older, of course your kids are going to have better reflexes than you. They're going to be faster. They're, you know, they will have the advantage of youth. And the reason you can, the reason I said that I will always be better than them is because what I will have is wisdom and treachery. And also the psychological barrier of being their dad. You must play to your strengths. Your strengths are no longer your reflexes. That you can't lean on that. You have to use what you have, which is life experience and the ability to ruthlessly betray and, you know, and be sneaky and you know, use your wisdom and experience. Now, how is me always being better than my kids working out? I hope I also said this, which is maybe I didn't foresee this, which is like that we would be interested in different games. So there are games that my son plays that I have never played and have no interest in, and presumably he's better than me in them. But I still think that if I did play those games and was interested in them, that I would still beat him. For the games that we both play equally, I must rely on my wisdom and treachery to defeat him. So he's pretty close in a lot of them, especially first-person shooters. I think I'm mostly better just because I make better decisions, which is most of what being good at first-person shooters actually is. It's not actually reflexes most of the time. But because his reflexes are so much better than mine, I really have to outthink him to sort of level that playing field, but it can happen. You mentioned, like, Adam watching all the YouTube videos involved. I'm doing that. I subscribe to so many gaming YouTube channels. All I do is, like, half of my YouTube watching is learning things about video, like Destiny videos. I subscribe to so many Destiny channels. Now that I'm playing Arc Raiders, I'm just constantly watching Arc Raiders videos to learn things. So that is part of sort of being into the games. And I don't expect him to be better than me in the games that I'm playing and he's not, for example. So that's sort of the you know, the calculus there. The caveat should have been I'll always be better than my kids in video games if we both play the game. But if one of us plays it, the other one doesn't, obviously it's unfair. And on that note, recently I was over a friend of mine's house and he suggested that we play it's an Apple Arcade game, which luckily we're all Apple Arcade subscribers. But it basically, you know, Network Name That Tune. What is it called? It's not actually a very nice application, so I'm a little bit annoyed at it. I think it's called...
I'm so surprised to hear that.
It's called Song Pop Party. Song Pop is all one word, capital S, capital P, and then a space, and then the word party. It's Network Name That Tune. And their UI is inscrutable. Like, they have never seen, like, information architecture is foreign to them. They have no idea what a hierarchy is. It's just like, how do I get from here to there and shoot? You just want to, like, I just want to pick a playlist and play it, the game with these songs. And, oh, it's maddening. Anyway, it's available on phone and iPad, and you can play it on Apple TV, and it's just Name That Tune. It's multiple choice Name That Tune, so everyone gets the app on their phone or whatever. You should play it on the phone because using the Apple TV remote is a massive disadvantage because it sucks. And it's multiple choice. You all hear the song start playing immediately, and you have four buttons on the screen, and you have to press the button that's the right answer. Sometimes the button that's the right answer is the title of the song, sometimes it's the artist. That's basically the whole game. It's Apple Arcade, so there's no in-app purchase, but you do have to unlock things by earning keys. It's like, come on, Apple Arcade. I already pay for you. There's no in-app purchase. You're not making any money. Why are you time-gating these things behind XP? It's so stupid. Anyway,
well, that's all this that's is just leading because, up like, to. You know, in the same way that, like, when we were growing up, arcade games were a thing, and then a lot of times they would be ported to the home consoles, but they still acted like arcade games, like where you'd have to, you know, like insert credits or whatever. Like they still had game remnants. This is like all the Apple Arcade games that were like, you know, ports from regular App Store games. They all have like remnants of the in-app purchase grinding garbage mechanics that all these games have now. Those remnants are still there sometimes.
I'm not sure if this is an Apple Arcade game that existed outside of it, but I think it might be. Is you might get paid based on playtime.
Oh.
Like an Apple Arcade. And so if you're incentivized to keep people playing your game, then you're going to lock all the stuff behind, like, you know. Anyway, I'm not sure of the details. That's annoying. But if you consider this a game, this is an interesting one to play with your kids. It's not, granted, it's not really a video game. It's Name That Tune. But, like, it works exactly how you would expect. If I pick, like, the 80s TV show playlist, I'll crush everybody, right? But if my kids pick, like, current music, I have no idea who these people are. it's really struggle to find a playlist for like a round of the game that is remotely fair because our cultural differences are so huge. You can also, by the way, play with strangers. When you play with strangers, you get to sort of pick, like, I'd like this to be the playlist. And it just randomly, every person picks what playlist they wish it was. And then it randomly picks amongst them. And, like, you know, I'll pick, like, Billy Joel. You can do artist-based ones. I crush pretty much everybody in Billy Joel.
I'm guessing there's not a Fish live performance one.
Well, that might be tricky. I didn't see Fish in there. But you have to unlock the things. I unlocked Billy Joel and U2. And, like, I think the Police or something. And I unlocked a bunch of 80s things, including, like, movie soundtracks and TV show themes. Although sometimes the TV show themes, they'll play a portion that didn't play at the beginning of the TV show, which I think is bad and wrong. Like, you should... I know the songs are longer, often longer than they were at the beginning of the show, but you can only play the part that played in front of the TV show.
Yeah, obviously. I thought, actually, a good engagement mechanic might be that the Fish playlist starts out unlocked and you have to rank up to lock it.
Well, no, the Fish one would be hard because I'm not sure if humans choose the excerpt. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So, like, if they don't, if you randomly choose an excerpt from a Fish song, I think even you would be challenged.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them that, you know, once they kind of go off in the wilderness for a while, you're like, I don't know what the heck this one
yeah,
is.
Yeah, maybe it would be fitting for, instead of it being like 5-second snippets, the Fish ones, they play 3 minutes of the song.
Yeah, and still no one knows what the heck it is.
Still people are going shrugging.
It's 20 minutes ago?
It's multiple choice. The most fun part is, like, when, especially when you're playing with, like, strangers online, they'll play one and it's clear nobody in the game, in the lobby or whatever, has any idea, but then they'll sing the lyric that is the title and then everyone picks it. You can see it happen. That makes me think that it's not human curated, because you should never pick a snippet that has the title in, like, where they say the title of the song with the, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio gif, right? So, anyway, a network name that tune is a fun game idea. Just, like, draw something. A network Pictionary is also a fun game idea. This is a poor implementation of it, but if you have Apple Arcade, you get it for free. And it's an interesting, quote-unquote, video game to play with your kids, because there is very often not that much overlap between the world of your cultural references and the world of theirs.
Yeah. I like to show the variance in gaming selection. The game that Adam is currently very heavily playing is called Ultra Kill. You should look this up. And what he is doing in it is basically, like, trying to beat his best times through the level in, like, a speed running kind of method. Now, when I, as an old person, see this game and I see the way he is speed running it, it looks like kind of a regular shooter, but he's basically flying through it, because he's, like, doing these, like, crazy speed run jumps and jumping and soaring and flying and like, whoa, how did you get all the way over there in 3 seconds? And, oh, I shaved off 0.1 seconds off my best time. It's like, oh my god, like, there's so much going on. This game is
retro, and Adam probably doesn't even know it. It looks very much like Quake 1 or Quake 2, but much faster, obviously. But, like, the graphics are, like, intentionally retro, but for a time that wasn't retro to...
Oh, yeah. Well, my favorite thing is, like, the font used throughout the entire UI is that, like, VCR bitmap font.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
Yep.
I saw it and I was delighted by it. I'm like, even though this... at no point did anything with that font look like this. Like, those are two not overlapping time spans.
Mm-hmm.
But it was delightful. But, like, when you look at this game, you're like, I have no idea what's going on here. And it's just so much of it. Like, this is... And, like, you know, besides this, he'll play those kind of, like, grinding economy games that are just, like, you know, some, like, Roblox pile of hacks that'll be like, well, now, you know, I just traded in the Mega Sword for the Ultra Sword, but to get the Diamond Sword, I have to get 5 million of these bags of rice. And it's like, oh my god, like, that sounds... I mean, honestly, to me, it sounds super unfun, but he has fun with it, so, you know, whatever.
Hey,
and then I see games like this
Universal
where I'm just like, he's doing things that are, like, impossible in this game. Like, I can't believe what's going on in this game.
You should try Universal Paperclips, one of the, I think that was what it was called, one of the original web-based ones.
Oh, I did.
Sort of, like, economy games.
Yeah, I actually did play that for, you know, a few days.
But has Adam played it?
I don't know. He also, there's all these, like, clickers now that are basically that same kind of game. He was just telling me about one the other day, like, one of the many, it was Cookie Clicker. That was the one. That's what the kids are playing now or recently. And that's, like, it sounds exactly like all of those games. But it's like, I just need 5 million more of these things, and I'll have it in 35 days. Like, oh my god.
he likes Ultra Kill. He might like the recent entries in the Doom franchise. I don't know if you two know, but they keep making Doom games, and they are very much like Ultra Kill, but with a little bit better graphics.
Huh.
I didn't know that. I knew that they were putting, well, not they, but people were putting Doom on all sorts of hilarious pieces of hardware, but I did not know that new Doom
many,
was
many
happening.
Doom games.
He's probably run out of potato
the original
now.
Doom. And they keep making them, and they keep making you them faster, very much like Ultra Kill, where you move real fast, you go real fast, there's lots of bullets. It's, you know, not attempting to be realistic in any way. It's not quite as speedrunny as this seems to be, but he might enjoy it.
All right, that's it for this segment?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let me scroll. Okay. All right, thank you to our sponsors this week, Aura Frames, Zapier, and Paka. And thanks to our members who support us directly, you can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic, which John just moved by closing Ask ATP.
Oh, sorry. It should move the scroll back for you, I feel like.
I agree.
It does. I know it does, but it shouldn't.
One of the perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about, should we ever be forced to put away our phones to have phone-free experiences? Things like events and things that require your phone to be away and how they do that. Interesting topic, I think. So we're going to talk about that in Overtime. You can join if you want to listen to that and everything else we do for members exclusively. atp.fm/join. Thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week. So I just did an Overcast update a few days back that adds the number one customer-requested feature for probably the last year by far. Episode images.
Tell me more about what that means.
Okay, so a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, podcasts have always had like the main podcast image that is like the artwork that shows to represent a podcast, a square that is, you know, showing when the podcast is in lists and showing when it plays. There was a long time, for a very, very long time ago, there's been support basically since the beginning of podcasting for images to be embedded in the MP3 files, because MP3s themselves support images being embedded in the ID3 tags, and they have for 1,000 years. So you could, you had your podcast image, it was specified in the feed as a URL, just an image URL in the feed, and you've been able to embed images in the MP3s themselves. And in many podcast players, if you would play a podcast with an embedded image, that image would show on the Now Playing screen instead of the main artwork if one was present. Now, a long time ago, that actually caused me a problem with Overcast early on in the development, because the wonderful, now I believe now totally over podcast Core Intuition by our friends Daniel Jockett and Manton Reese. Core Intuition was one of my test shows a 1,000 years ago, and they used to embed a lower resolution version of their main image as their embedded image in every file. And Overcast's initial logic was, if there is an embedded image, display that. And if not, display the main artwork. Now, the result of this was, when playing Core Intuition back then, it would quickly pop in a worse version of the main image, because that was the embedded image, because it had to be kind of, you know, smaller to fit into limits and stuff. And so I originally, episode artwork meant that. And even that, I had to like develop. Basically, I did something where like I resized both images down to like 16 by 16 pixels and measured the differences and like how different these two images are. And if the embedded image was deemed to be like basically the same image as the main feed image, I would just show the main feed one and just ignore it.
You're probably ruining a lot of people's subtle jokes where they changed like one letter in the title of their name as a joke artwork, but you replaced it with the real artwork because it's shrunk down. They're the same.
Well, the good news is the embedded artwork feature of the MP3 spec and of podcast apps has hardly ever been used. Now, the world has moved on since then, and Overcast still supports that and has the entire time. But
we use it all the time in this show, right? Or no, we use chapter images.
Yeah, see, we stopped. We did use it in this show, and chapter images we did. Anyway, we moved on. The world has moved on. No one ever really used those in great numbers. Now,
and just to be clear, the distinction we're making is chapter images are a different thing where images are embedded in the MP3 file, which is separate from episode images where there is a artwork image embedded in the MP3 file saying, for this episode, this is the artwork.
Right, exactly. So, over the last few years, it's become fairly common for, especially for larger podcasts who have like production staffs and designers on staff and stuff, larger podcasts will often have individual images made for each episode. And what they do is Apple Podcasts added support, I think a couple of years ago at least, for images to be specified in the feed per episode. So it's just in the feed, it's just another URL, and you know the feed has to download it, or the client has to download it and show it. And then this takes it out of the file. And the advantage of this is that you can show them before the episodes have been downloaded. So if you're presenting like a list of episodes that have not yet been downloaded, all those images that are present, they can be shown in that list. So it's helpful, and it's kind of nicer for like the rich display of podcasts now with big budgets and all these, you know, all these assets and design things that they can have now. So for a long time now, my number one feature request has been support for these episode images. Now, of course, I try to go implement them, and I run into so many little problems. So first of all, step one of implementing episode images is I have to start parsing them from the feed and saving them on my database rows for episodes. So I have to like add a field. Okay. And then start saving them, and I start seeing, all right, what are these like? Are they huge? Now, first of all, keep in mind the scope and the scale that you're dealing with now is Overcast is hosting metadata for and crawling millions of podcasts. Now, every podcast has one main image. You're going now from the potential of a podcast having one main image to 2,000 episode images, maybe? So you're dealing with like potentially orders of magnitude more images that need to be dealt with. Now, the most obvious way to do this is just ignore them on the server side and just have the client download them directly from publishers at full size. Then the servers don't have to know anything about them except this is the image URL. Go nuts. The problem with that, there's a number of problems with that. So I'll get to that in a minute. But first, that is what I prototyped first. Now, the very first thing I had to do was build an all-new downloader for Overcast. Because what this means is you are, like, in the before support times of this, Overcast had to download one file for every episode. So the downloader was kind of tightly bound to one-to-one relationship between episodes and files that can be downloaded for those episodes. So I first had to refactor the downloader, and in fact I ended up writing a whole new one for other reasons, but refactor the downloader and design it such that a podcast can have more than one file associated with its with downloading for it. And there's all sorts of tricks to that. Like, okay, well, what happens if one of them gets deleted? What happens if one of them is downloaded but the other ones aren't? What happens if the file is being streamed during playback and not downloaded? What should happen if it's in your list but it is not downloaded? What should show there? There's all sorts of these considerations. There's also a privacy angle. Because keep in mind, the world of podcasts is all about ad tech in all of its forms now. Now, you know, fortunately, it can't do quite as much as it can on the web because of the limitations of the medium. But any little bit of information you give these, you know, big ad networks that are now serving podcasts, they'll use it against you. Like, so it's like talking to the police. Like, give them as little as possible. and so making a second request from the same IP, well, when do you make that request? Do you download every image, even if you haven't downloaded the file? But then you're making a request two different times, and maybe they can like bind two different IPs to your, you know, data profile that they're keeping on you, and then they can figure, oh, you, this is your home IP and this is your work IP. There's all sorts of stuff that you got to think about with that kind of stuff. You know, what if they specify a quote pixel, and then you have to think about like, are they going to change the URL over and over again to, you know, to make sure that you keep downloading it so they can keep tracking you as you go throughout your life and as you move to different IPs in different locations? The answer is yes, of course, the people are going to try to do that. If they're not doing it yet, they're going to. So you have to design any kind of feature like this with privacy like significantly in mind. And then the second problem is like, okay, you're downloading images now. What happens if the image changes after you've downloaded it? How often are you checking? What happens if the URL changes? What happens if the URL doesn't change, but somebody replaces the image on their server? Do you keep the cached version forever? Do you have to pull potentially thousands of image URLs client-side every single time? Like, there's, when you think about what actually has to happen here to do this well, it's not a small amount of work. So I refactor my downloader to download the images directly and from the publisher, so that way my servers wouldn't have to deal with millions more images and whatever that might mean. Okay. I try it out and I run it on, you know, in the iOS simulator on a test account that has a handful of podcasts in it. And it was 500 megs of images on a test account with a handful of podcasts. I'm like, what the heck is going on? And so at first I look and I see there's one image that I have about 100 copies of. It's the artwork for Hypercritical. So it turns out that one thing that you know, 5x5 feed now has is they specify images per episode, even if there never were images per episode for like a very old podcast. They just specify the same URL for every image. Like, oh no, duplicates. And you can't count on podcast feeds doing anything in a regular logical way. They're going to do whatever they're going to do. So then I have to, all right, now re-index things with the consideration that maybe you shouldn't count an image as being an episode image if it's been used before in the same feed, if it's the main artwork episode, or if they're using it for a bunch of other episodes. So I had to dedupe all those URLs, ignore any URL that appeared more than once. But then in a later test, I learned that breaks dithering, because dithering uses different URLs, but it uses each image for like a month. So every episode, so you'll have like, you know, 8 episodes of dithering in a row that have the same image URL, but then it'll change. And so if you say
content addressable storage,
what?
It'd be storing them based on their content, not based on their name or anything. So then you could say, when you download one, you can say, oh, I can discard this because I've already got this file.
But then you're still downloading it a million times.
It's true, but you're not keeping it a million times. Oh, geez. So it wouldn't take up 500 megs.
Yeah, but then I'm basically building like a file system at that point. Then I'm like, all right, well, this thing references this block, or, you know, then you can delete one.
The content like S3 has things that will kind of do this for you. But anyway, yeah, go on. Like, you'll get there eventually.
Yeah, so my deduplication thing, you know, had to like be revised a lot. It still didn't get there. But whatever. All right. Then I'm like, okay, now comes the other problem. All right, so I try it out and it's like, the images are way too big and they're still not available without downloading the full size images from the publishers. So as you are scrolling a list of episodes that you don't have downloaded yet, those are having to download these huge images, popping them in. And if you make the iPhone download an image from a publisher, you have to be very, very careful not to do anything with that image that might load it into memory and blow up the phone before you know for sure that it's safe. And I don't necessarily mean safe in terms of security vulnerabilities. I mean safe that it won't exceed the memory limits of the phone or cause a huge amount of processing time. So like there used to be, back in the day, I remember Jason and Mike were joking about this, that like at some point, I think one of them accidentally published the upgrade artwork as a JPEG 2000 file at a time when JPEG 2000 was not well supported, which is every time. And for some reason, like it was served and it was fine. And because Apple's image processing frameworks can read it, Overcast was dutifully reading it. Maybe it was just a chapter art, whatever it was. It was reading it, but it was incredibly slow to read. And while that chapter was playing, the interface would lag like crazy because it was like trying to parse this giant JPEG as an image. And so you have to be very careful with like, you know, kind of untrusted input. And so I have all these things in place that like use certain image IO functions on the client side to like first read the dimensions of the image. And if it's above a certain dimension, don't even try to decode it. And then also check the format of the image. And if it's not like, you know, JPEG ping, you know, if it's not one of like the simple, well-known ones, don't even bother. Don't try to read it. It's like there's all these different checks I have to do. This is just to illustrate kind of the complexity of having the client process images. So then I get to the problem of like not being able to see them in scrolling lists without downloading all of these giant images from publishers. And I'm like, oh, my God. I have to thumbnail them server side and put them behind a CDN. That's the real answer here. I really just had like, and that's what I do for main podcast artwork. Also, the client is not downloading podcast artwork from the publisher. It's downloading it from my CDN, and my CDN is doing like my servers are doing the resizing and sticking them on the S3 compatible storage thing and being served through Cloudflare, so it's free. And that's the whole process. But then I'm like, okay, now I got to be careful because now I'm going to start thumbnailing millions of images again.
On the thumbnailing front, I just ran across this because I was looking at some code for an app that you will never guess because it has nothing to do with thumbnails. But it was like someone posting fast core graphics thumbnailing code that I think its pitch was it never has to have the full big image in memory. Like essentially you can, if you've got the full size image somewhere accessible, like on the file system, that you could make a thumbnail without ever reading and putting into, without ever expanding, sort of like uncompressing the entire JPEG 2000, that somehow it would make you a thumbnail while iteratively reading the thing in chunks or something. And that, I mean, I know you're probably doing it server side using whatever, you know, server side library you have, but I'm wondering if you ran across that in your travels in terms of, can I make thumbnails without loading the whole image?
I've seen a bunch of those articles, like, because, you know, every few years, either some new API will come out or somebody will find some new, you know, method, or they'll run like some little benchmark and make a blog post about it saying this method, you know, changes images this much faster or whatever. But yeah, it's all happening server side now. It's all using like Image Magic, you know, server side. So that's
in PHP?
From PHP. I mean, it's not.
But Image Magic is doing the actual.
Yes.
Image Magic.
Yeah, exactly.
With a K.
Yes.
Well done.
Anyway, so I'm like, all right, now I got to build this stuff. So then I go and build that. And it, you know, that takes weeks to start like filling the back catalog, doing all the thumbnailing. Oh, it's so much work. And then I'm about to launch the feature. And one morning I start seeing that all my S3 put commands are returning 403s. Like, what is going on? Now, the object service I was using to store it, because it was way cheaper than S3 and it was local to my servers, was Linode Object Storage. Linode now Akamai, but it's still, you know, Linode branded. So Linode Object Storage is their S3 compatible block storage. Almost every web hosting thing has their own S3 compatible block storage kind of thing. And so I was putting it there because it was very inexpensive, and I put Cloudflare in front of it to serve it really fast, so that part didn't really matter. Well, it turns out I created my Linode Object Storage bucket on their like legacy version of it. And now they have buckets that have high limits. But the one I hit had a limit of like 50 million objects or something like that. A five with a lot of zeros at the end. I think it was 50 million. Just an artificial limit, that many objects. And once you hit it, they don't email you or warn you in advance or anything. You can start getting 403 errors whenever you try to write any new images to it. So that was fun to figure out. And I'm like, I opened a support ticket. I'm like, hey, can I get a higher limit? And they're like, nope, you got to move to a whole different data center to do that. I'm like, oh, my God. So this is now a bucket that has 50 million things in it. And I have to, and I was literally like about to release that build to the App Store. I was like, oh, God, now I have to delay this again because I hit Linode Object Storage's or old limit for the number of items in a bucket, which I didn't even know was a thing. Like, So then I took another, you know, week to slowly migrate all of those 50 million things to Cloudflare R2, which is Cloudflare's S3 clone for their block storage. So I moved everything to that. Change all the code in Overcast to point to that, and to make sure that all the stuff works to actually read and write to that properly. Do all that, all the image URLs change, everything. Like,
did you look up what the limits are for the new object storage?
No, because I know Cloudflare wouldn't have stupid limits like that.
I would look them up.
I would still look them up, even though I agree with
you. Just write them down somewhere.
And then, finally, I was able to launch the feature last week. And
what a pain in the butt.
The number one customer request now? Can I have a setting to turn that off?
Cool. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, because sometimes episode artwork is gross. I mean, I have a problem with main show artwork. Some podcasts I listen to have changed their, like, their main, you know, the artwork, the main artwork for the entire show to be hideous. And I wish I could just, like custom artwork, kind of like custom icons in the Finder. I don't like the icon this app changed, and I changed it. Ugh. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm surprised you don't have some, like, Perl script that's just putting a facade in front of the official RSS, but inserting your own preferred artwork.
I could do that if I really cared that much, but I mean, there's enough problems dealing with podcast RSS feeds that I don't want to add another layer there, so now I can just blame Marco for everything.
No, that works for me.
Everyone else does.
Right. Well, so it shipped, and other than people saying, I hate this because different, everyone is happy, by and large.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part. Well, and there's also, by the way, there's the massive, like, UI question of where and when do these images get displayed during playback or not during playback. So there's a number of schools of thought here. So where I'm displaying them now is if you are viewing an individual podcast's screen and you're seeing its list of episodes, they will show there, and they will show during playback in the now playing screen and anywhere the now playing image would show. So things like CarPlay, the lock screen, control center, you know. But if you have a playlist or a widget, a context where you're seeing episodes from different podcasts possibly being blended together, they are not showing there. I'm showing the regular podcast artwork there, like the main show artwork there, because my rationale there is like if like in a context where you need to distinguish podcasts from each other, the main artwork is how you visually identify that podcast. So if you had shows that have, like, you know, radically different images per episode, which many of them do, you wouldn't recognize the show. And if you had more than one of those shows in a list together, you'd have no idea what shows you were looking at without, like, reading a little tiny, you know, title text or whatever. So, like, it's a better UI, I think, to only show it in single podcast contexts. But again, like what I think is not necessarily what everyone thinks, and so that many people are, you know, thinking like that's not what they want. So it's just, it's a very tricky problem to solve. I played with like having in a mixed podcast context, like a playlist, having the regular episode artwork show, or having the regular podcast artwork show with the individual episode artwork in some form. Like maybe like I tried having the regular podcast album art as a little tiny inset thing, like on the lower right corner of the main, but it just looked cluttered and confusing, and then you're obstructing the artwork. Like there were so many problems with everything else I tried. So that's why I went with this. But even that, like, it's a really tough feature to get right. It sounds so simple. Episode images, yeah. And then every single one of these details was harder and more cumbersome and time consuming than I thought it would be. Which I guess is software development, but this I thought was an especially long saga for something that seems so simple.
It's funny you say that. I don't want to go too deep into this for a bunch of different reasons, or at least not now anyway. But one of my most frequent requests was the Discover screen on Callsheet, the main screen you land on. Those things like popular movies, popular TV shows, new movies, new TV shows. A lot of times the entries there that TMDB provides are kind of inexplicable. And a lot of people have been asking, can I turn some of these off? Can I rearrange them? Can I do both, etc.? And so just finished rolling out in the last 24 or 48 hours is the ability to turn on or off each of those sections, which a lot of people have been asking for a long time. And then I am mostly done with implementing the ability to rearrange those sections, which is not currently possible. And it's funny because both of these things I knew people wanted for months and months and months and months. And I kept kicking the can, because I felt like it was going to be really, really difficult to implement. And then when I finally told myself, stop being a baby and do it, it actually wasn't that bad. It was not without peril for sure, but it was one of those things, unlike what you're describing, where it's so far been mostly straightforward, and I'm kind of mad at myself for kicking the can. But there have definitely been times that I kick the can for a long time, go to finally implement it and go, oh, this was a mess. Like the multiple lists of pins is a great example of that. Like I got there, but it was way messier than I thought it would be. And I already thought it was going to be messy as hell. So I've been on both sides of this. Sometimes you just got to buckle down and give it a shot and see what happens. And I'm sorry for your sake that this one was not an easy one, but I'm glad you got it across the line, and it's got to be a big weight off your shoulders.
Yeah, it really is. And now it's a big weight onto Cloudflare's shoulders, but hey, that's not my problem.
Nice.
No, to them, it's nothing. You know, that's the advantage of using one of these big providers for some of this stuff. It's like, to them, like, it's something like 2 terabytes of images, but like, they don't care.
Okay, titles.
All right, let's see.
Sorry, a little bit of that one snuck through. I really like Do You Have a Dragon? I like Tapestry
of
Wonder.
We used that one already. That's what I was referencing, the episode where we used it.
Did we? God, I don't remember.
Exactly like that, I believe.
No, fair enough. I also like Tapestry of Wonder and Wisdom and Treachery.
Yeah, those are, I think Tapestry of Wonder is my number one, Wisdom number two.
I think I feel that the reverse of that, but I obviously really like both of them.
The top voted one should so clearly be egg exclamation point, but I'm not picking that. I like Wisdom and Treachery.
All right, that's going to be the winner then. Give me just a moment.
I don't know if Treachery is spelled right. Spell check that, please.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that A is there. I had to look it up. But
Just double check. We've got computers. You can right click on things.
No, I'm pretty sure
it's
right.
Yeah, I think it's right.
Yeah.
At least according to Apple Dictionary.
All right, one more second, and we can go to overtime. Did that MDash work? Yes, it did. All right. We are back to Wednesday of next. What is that, December 3rd? Is that right? Yes.
Yes.
All right, cool. All right, goodbye, live people.
Thanks, live
people. Happy Thanksgiving.
See you later. Have fun. Safe travels, all that stuff. Bye. Why can't I click this menu?